Hey everybody, I just wanted to give you a quick reminder that we've just got about 10 days left. I've got a big sale going on. All of my books are half price. Kindles are just $5. If you want the full transcript of these interviews, such as Jim Van Cannon, these are just $6. This is going on just through September 15th, 2017. So please go to Amazon.com, just do a quick search for Gospel Tangents, and you'll pull these up. Jim Van Cannon, member of the First Presidency of the Remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. David Rosenvall has a theory of the Book of Mormon in the Baha. Darren Smith, big expert on BYU and black sports athletes. Also, Paul Reeve, Dr. Paul Reeve from the University of Utah. Dr. Richard Bennett, BYU professor on the Kirtland Temple. And, of course, Brian Hales on polygamy. I've also got Kurt Bench, but I actually gave away my copy. So anyway, get those. That sale goes on just for about another 10 days or so, maybe even less than that when you're listening to this. It's going to end soon, so get your copies now. We'd really appreciate your support so that we can produce some documentaries on Mormon history. Thanks a lot. Many of you remember the dark day of September 11th, 2001, when Muslim terrorists attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. It was a dark day in U.S. history. 160 years ago, this September 11th, is another dark day in Mormon history as Mormon settlers in southern Utah attacked and killed 120 men, women, and children, known as the Mountain Meadows Massacre. It turns out that there's been some DNA tests done to answer some questions about that horrific incident. It's a pretty interesting conversation. Dr. Ugo Perego will introduce a little bit of the massacre and talk about his test to answer questions about the DNA of certain people in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Check out our conversation.
Many, many people, especially since the gospel topics have been published, there is one about peace and violence, and they talk specifically about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. So many members probably of the church are not familiar with the event, but now that there is a gospel topic about it, I think a few more maybe now have been exposed to it. It is not a happy event, nothing to be happy about it, but there are people involved in descendants of those people that are alive, and so there are still search for for answers to some of the questions of why, what, who, to some degree. The first involvement I had with the Mountain Meadows Massacre came because the claim was that out of this party of 120 people that left Arkansas and were moving to California as they went through the Salt Lake Valley and then down all the way to Fillmore and then Cedar City and out in the Mountain Meadows area, after the ambush that was done by local Mormons, local people that live in the area, and natives, there were 120 people that were exterminated. They were all killed, except children and age 8 or younger. And but the number of those children that were spared has never really been confirmed. That was some sources, some earlier sources, the first sources, say 17, but soon that number became 18, and most documents and books that have been written on the subject would carry on this 18 number, right? Why is this important? Because these children are probably spared because they would think they're too young to remember or hold grudge, you know, about what happened, were given, or maybe because they were considered innocent based on Mormon theology, you know, whatever that was the reason, they were given to local families and raised as their own. And it wasn't until a couple years later when the U.S. government made an investigation on what happened that some of that truth came out, and it was, you know, 2 years now by this time. And they, the record said that only 17 of these 18 children were identified and returned to relatives to Arkansas. So who was the 18th child, right? What happened to this child? Who was it? And as years went by, there have been rumors that one of these child was the oldest daughter of Bishop Klingsmith, who was involved with the massacre. So he is there, right?
So the daughter was essentially adopted by Bishop Klingon.
That's what the claim was, okay? The 18th child was the one that was, there was no return, right? So making up something bad into something worse, because now you have a child, doesn't belong to you, give it back to the family, right? And so there was all this controversy surrounding, you know, because as these things surfaced, you know, the people involved had already been dead. You know, Bishop Klingsmith has been dead, the daughter has died, right? So what we have is people in this center, in this past 100 years, trying to collect information and putting pieces together. So what we have is rumors, you know, that the child, Priscilla was her name, which, by the way, the massacre took place, as you say, September 11, 1857. Priscilla was born in 1855, which placed her at an age group of two, being one or two children that could have been spared, right? So we have her born in 1855, Bishop Klingsmith being involved with the massacre, being there, so he is, he could be one of the people that took a child in, right? And there is no birth certificate for this girl, nowhere to be found, right? So we have a number of situations, in addition to all the rumors that built on in life, you know, later on in life as she grew up, and people thought, you know, she was one of the survivors of the massacre and so on and so forth. Now she married, she had posterity, right? And so descendants of Priscilla, especially one in particular that have written also on the Mountain Meadow Massacre, and she was convinced, his descendant and others, that Priscilla was a survivor of the massacre, that Klingsmith was not her family. And so she approached me, and she said, you know, with the DNA studies that we're doing, the techniques that we're developing about linking people to their ancestors, is there a way that we can find out for sure if Priscilla was Klingsmith's daughter or not? So that was my first involvement with the Mountain Meadow Massacre, discovering the 18th child. And what we did, we used a technique called mitochondrial DNA. It's a piece of DNA that is inherited only from mother to children. So it would have been this woman that we were doing the research with. We identify others to make sure that we had more samples, right, as controls to. If you only test one person, it might give you a partial answer, but when you test multiple descendants on the same line, the answer becomes stronger. You know, you can eliminate other possibilities that might have intervened in altering your results. And so I identified three descendants of connected to the Klingsmith family eventually, and they all agreed to test three or four. I can't remember exactly the number, but that's been published a number of years ago. And what we did, we traced the maternal line, so to that would be Bishop Klingsmith's wife, right? Priscilla had a sister, a biological daughter of the Klingsmith, that was born in 1859, so 2 years after the massacre, so removes her from the massacre scenes. So we tested a descendant of the sister with a descendant of Priscilla, and a descendant of Priscilla's mother's sister, right? So that's a little bit of an outside line. And if they are all related biologically, they should all share the same mitochondrial line, same mitochondrial profile. If not, Priscilla would have had one that would be different than the other two. Because, and at the end of the study, they all share the same mitochondrial profile, not only. That profile is fairly rare in the general population, so what are the odds that they would all have the same exact profile and belong to the same family? So the conclusion from the paper was that probably Priscilla was the biological daughter of the Klingsmith family and not the surviving child. And after that was published, Rick Turley from at the time was the managing director of the Church History Department, I believe that was the was his title. He was writing that book on the Mountain Meadow Massacre, and he told me that earlier records actually had 17 as the number, but then for some reason have been dismissed and the 18 numbers survived. So it seems like this would be a good match, you know, between historical records and genetic record, and that's how my first involvement was and with the Manta Meno massacre. The paper you're talking about actually is a different research.
Yeah, so I wasn't familiar with that story. I was familiar with a different paper. So
yeah,
that's how.
Usually, what happens is when you open a door, you don't know what's on the other side of the door. And so, when I opened the Manta Meno massacre door, the successive project, the follow-up project, was what caused the massacre. You know. And Rick Turley, that at the time has read my paper, you know, that was published in the Journal of Mormon History, mentioned the fact that he suspected that, to make the story very short, you know, when the party arrived to Fillmore, above Fillmore, and as they're moving down, some of their cattle died. And not only their cattle, but also, it seems apparently, some of the local cattle died as well. I'm not 100% sure to what extent that happened, but there was some of the animals that died unexpectedly. Locals claim, and that's what's on the record, that the party that was going through poisoned the springs, which caused some of the animals to die in an attempt to kill actually the people there, right? Now, this is absurd, because to put poison in a spring, which is running water, you know, to the extent that it's actually the poison stays there, you need a tremendous amount of poison. But, you know, at that time there is, like, you know, this folk magic, these, you know, ideas that things can actually happen without being able to test the possibility that you can actually do something like that. But the problem was that they gave these cattle that were dead as a gift to the local natives as a right to pass. And natives, Native Americans, do accept gift of dead animals. They're a little bit, at least in this part, I'm not an expert in anthropological and cultural Native American, but from what I read is that they're kind of like a little bit like scavengers, you know, they would eat whatever they could eat, right? And at that time, seems like it was unacceptable. Things they received is dead animals, and the natives died. They get really sick and they die. And a local child, from a family, as he was trying to take the skin off of one of those cows, what's the name, Hive?
The hide.
As he was trying to take the hide off, scratched his face, and within a few days it was dead. Devastating dead. Like, his whole face blew out, like a really swallow, and blood started coming out from everywhere, and he died.
Right? This is a Mormon child.
That's a Mormon child, Fillmore. His name was Proctor Robinson, and he died, I think, was age 16, just a few days after the massacre, as the disease developed. And because of these things, the theory is that escalated the conflict between natives, Mormons, and the party. They thought, at least one of the reasons, again, it could be not all the reason, but they thought that these people came and were arming natives and Mormons, you know.
The Fanchers thought that...
Yeah, no, the locals thought that the Fanchers were army, because the Fanchers are the ones that had the dead animals.
Okay.
And they gave the dead animals, or either left them there or gave them to the natives, right? So Proctor Robinson approached one of these dead animals. He dies. The natives receive some of these dead animals as a gift from the Fanchers. They die, right? So these Fanchers are doing something wrong, right? And so then they follow them down to Cedar City, to the Manta Meno, and then there is the attack. So what I'm thinking is that there have been a number of conflict or issues that build up, and then eventually it is a dead animal issue has escalated to the point in which now we are justified in doing something to these people. Is, you know, an eye for an eye, you know, they're killing us, we're killing them, something like that. I mean, it could be many other reasons. Not everybody probably agreed on this kind of conclusion, but it definitely brings up an interesting event in the number of events that preceded that massacre. Now, Rick Turley believed that anthrax could have been the reason why these animals died. That's just like his idea. And so he asked me if I could look into that from a science point of view. So what I did, I gathered some information with regard to first of all, how anthrax is manifested, how it affects individuals and animals, what are the likelihood? Because at that time, anthrax was not known. All right, it was probably endemic in America. There were many cases of it, but people just didn't know the cause of it. It was not yet identified and classified as a pathogen. And so I look at the historical records. One of the Fancher people actually died in Wyoming, and they thought it was because of a spider bite. So that's what was recorded in a local paper, and I found that record that they thought that they died of that. And likelihood that you die of a spider bite in North America is fairly slim compared to other places in the world. We don't have a lot of very poisonous spiders, and they usually know very aggressive that they will actually come and find you while you sleep and kill you, you know. Kind of like an arachnophobia type of scenario there. But if you look at the symptoms of anthrax, are very similar to that of spider bites. What happens is that you probably have already a little open wound, like a scratch or something, and then the spore, the toxin from anthrax will get on your skin and then create necrosis of the skin, so your skin will die around it. And it will create like a dead hole, you know, just like the poison of a spider, you know, as it bites, create that of that tissue around there and look like a little volcano on your arm. So if you know, you put pictures of anthrax contamination symptoms with spider bites, they actually look fairly similar, right? So, and at that time, they definitely knew what a spider bite would look like, you know, but they didn't know what anthrax was. And so I did actually exhume Proctor Robinson's body in Fillmore. We had permission from the city and from the family, the descendants of Proctors. They were the one interested in knowing as well what he died of. And we look for traces of anthrax in the burial spot and in the bones. We couldn't find any, but after 150 years, it's also possible that with water infiltration and things like that would have been washed away. But definitely the medical documentation of what happened and the description of the death of this child with other events makes a pretty strong case that that he died of anthrax, that he was present in the area. Anthrax goes from animal to animal and from animals to humans, but not from human to human. And so that would explain why the individuals that died were only the ones that came in touch with the animals, but that you could tend to proctor and not be contaminated. Hmm. It's kind of interesting. But we did identify the bones. We did, he died in 1857. Burial records were not very good at that time. We were talking about 10 years of colonizing Utah, right? Or what will become the state of Utah. So this is pre-Utah time. So we have a cemetery that, there is this unmarked grave. There is a tombstone nowadays, but back it's a recent addition, you know, so we had to do an excavation. We did a DNA test on the bones. We compared the bones to the DNA results from the bones with their living descendants. We confirm that this was the child we were looking for, thanks to DNA analysis. We did ground sampling and bone sampling for DNA for presence of anthrax. We didn't find any, but in the meantime, we documented the whole thing, and it's most likely that. And that was the paper.
To me, this is just an amazing story to hear. So
It was good. I wish I could have come and presented at that time. It was like my really like to go to MHA conference, but that was an interesting thing, is that my PhD dissertation was being awarded in back at the university, and the College of Life Science every 2 years has a big PhD celebration, and they look at all the dissertation they produced in the last two years between all the different faculties in life science, and they give the award for best dissertation. And I was awarded that.
Oh, wow.
And so that was on the same week, and I was like, okay, between the two, I had to make a choice, and so Scott Woodward, who was my boss at that time, agreed to go and read the paper.
Yeah, and I remember hearing that. That was in Independence, if I remember right?
No, I think it was actually in Utah.
Oh, was it in St. George?
Yeah, it was in St. George, and that's why it was actually very relevant. I think it was actually the same year, I believe it was 2006 or 2007, whatever, that celebrated actually the 105th, commemorated the 150 years from the massacre.
Oh, really?
So probably it was 2007, I think. It has to be somewhere in there. I can't remember. 2002. I don't remember. But it was in southern Utah. It wasn't far from Salt Lake.
Oh wow! Yeah. So that was a fun, fascinating presentation. I hope you enjoyed our discussion with Dr. Ugo Perrigo. In our next conversation, we'll talk about biblical literalism. Does Dr. Ugo Perrigo believe the Bible was just 6,000 years old? What are some of his thoughts on that topic?
Had there been people living in the Americas 15,000 years ago, pre-flood time, pre-Adam and Eve time? And the answer is, why not? Because the church does not have a position about who lived before Adam and Eve. We know through Revelation there was an Adam and Eve. We know that we are all descendants of them, but the church has never said there was nothing before.
Click here to subscribe, click here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some other videos that we've done here on YouTube. We hope you'll use this as a valuable resource to learn more about Mormon history.